In the coming week, Afghans await what follows the Taliban seizure of Kabul. Foreign capitals grapple with the consequences of the collapse of Afghanistan's U.S.-backed government, and recriminations fly in the U.S. over the Taliban's return to power. It's August 19th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan has dominated the news this week, which is why we are devoting the entire episode of our show to it. But things have hardly settled down in Kabul or the rest of the country. Tension is now focused on who the Taliban will allow to leave the country and whether those departing will include the thousands of Afghans who work with U.S. and other Western countries. But that's only the start of the issue still being dealt with on the ground. So, Bob, can you set the scene for us and what we are likely to see in the coming week?
Sure, Jim. And I'll start out with the usual caveat for a weekly podcast that anything we say can and will be overtaken by events. But be that as it may, let me lay out what looks to be unfolding. And surely the first thing that many people are focusing on in the United States, at least, is the situation in terms of people being able to get out of the country, Americans and Afghan allies. There was a lot of comments yesterday from U.S. officials that the Taliban are sticking with agreements to allow all Americans who wish to get through checkpoints to get to the airport and get out. Not so clear about Afghans who have been given permission to come through, at least by the U.S. And there are tens of thousands of Afghans. I saw an estimate up to 65,000. So one big story is going to continue to be the flight out of Afghanistan for those wishing to go who are on a sort of approved list. There's also many more who would like to leave who feel vulnerable or threatened by the Taliban.
Bob, on just that point, do we have a good idea of how many Americans remain in country and how many foreign nationals from Western countries, allied countries, also are in Kabul or Afghanistan?
It's a surprisingly large figure, Jim. I saw some estimates up to 15,000 Americans, and this could be anything from contractors to civilian employees doing various tasks over there. There are quite a few that were in the country, which again speaks to the unexpected nature of the sweep to power of the Taliban and sweep to power in Kabul. I think the number of international nationals is also in the thousands. I don't know any more than that, Jim. It's still a considerable number. And so again, it's why there's been such heavy focus on who controls the airport. It looks to be something in the order of 9 or 10,000 U.S. forces are now controlling a perimeter. It's still a pretty tight perimeter of the airport. And are in conversation with Taliban officials about the security and the control of that area. But there is a long sort of line that stretches from central Kabul to the airport. And there are checkpoints all on the way that are controlled by the Taliban.
And we don't know where these 15,000 or so Americans are. I assume many are in Kabul, but many could also be spread across the country, including in cities to the far west of Afghanistan, like Herat, or in the north, like Mazar-i-Sharif.
Yeah, that's a good point. The assumption is that many of them are in Kabul, but certainly not all. Again, Americans were involved throughout the country. However, there also had been a very swift move to seize provinces by the Taliban this summer. So I think that had caused further amount of Americans to come into Kabul. Certainly thousands upon thousands of Afghans themselves have come into the city ahead of the takeover. So it's a question of what appears to be a concentration in Kabul and just processing the paperwork, locating and getting people onto flights that they're trying to establish in some sort of swift order to fly out of Afghanistan, Jim.
Well, I just should note on that point, Bob, if people are outside of Kabul, they presumably would have the option to go across a land border to a neighboring country. But there are two problems for that for Americans. One is the Taliban control all of the access points to Afghanistan's neighbors. The second is a number of those countries aren't countries I would imagine that American citizens want to enter right now, obviously Iran and obviously Pakistan.
That's correct. Those are where the main land borders are. There are also land borders into places like Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. But you're right, this is primarily an airlift out of Kabul scenario that we're hearing about from all the reporting I've seen, Jim. So that's the big logistical exercise that's underway. There's also a great deal of scrambling going on involving what will be the way the U.S. engages with this new leadership in Afghanistan, what will be the way its allies do, what will be the way in which Afghanistan is going to be run. There's the Taliban itself seeking to try to assert control. It's one thing to seize these capitals on these provinces. It's another to kind of expand your writ and to make deals that will allow the Taliban to take control. And the Taliban within itself is not necessarily a monolith by any means or a coherent, tightly organized, you know, party in any way. There's a political wing. There's obviously the military wing. And just as previously when the Taliban ruled in 1996 to 2001, this new version is a decentralized one. So we're going to learn a bit about how the Taliban Taliban is going to sort of strike deals to take on power. And then as far as that goes, you might see the international community, so-called, respond in kind, whether or not it actually extends recognition to this government, whether there's some sort of interim government. Many people are watching what's being called a transitional council that includes the former chief executive, Abdullah Abdullah, who's an ethnic Tajik, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a former warlord and longtime fighter in Afghanistan civil wars, the role they might play in brokering some sort of transitional government, obviously led by the Taliban, but not necessarily completely dominated by it. So it's the Taliban seeking to try to consolidate some sort of control. It's then how the international community responds. And we're already seeing things happening that the U.S. is trying to direct in particular with the freezing of aid, for example. There is a G7 meeting that's on the docket for next week, a summit meeting to sort of coordinate activities. One of the big things, presumably, is also the issue of an expectation of refugees, Jim. Afghanistan already has one of the largest numbers of refugees in the world, and that number is expected to rise sharply.
I take your point, Bob, about how much we don't know about the Taliban leadership, what the divisions are, and whether those divisions are going to grow or shrink now that the Taliban have seized power. I think one of the big decisions awaiting the Taliban is how they are going to deal with the continuation of Western forces in the country. Now, as you pointed out, so far, they are allowing planes to land and take off from Kabul International Airport. But clearly, the Taliban has the capacity through the use of mortars to make it difficult, if not impossible, for those planes to go in and out. And obviously, those planes are important for being able to take people out of Kabul. President Biden was asked this week if he would stick by his August 31 deadline for getting all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. And my takeaway from his conversation with George Stephanopoulos is if U.S. troops have to stay longer in order to get Americans out, they will stay longer. That obviously could come at odds with the Taliban's desires for the Americans and other foreign nationals to leave. And that would really throw a wrench in the Biden administration's withdrawal plans and force them to face some very difficult policy decisions.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Jim. And this is where we're going to kind of test the mettle of the Taliban leadership, but also the pragmatism. It does seem, and it's been pointed out repeatedly, that they are at best a fighting force of maybe 60,000. How does a force like that assert control over a country of something like 35 million and hold its own? So I don't think they're interested in getting into sort of a firefight with the U.S. I think they'll try to press the U.S. to leave the scene. But I think we might see this situation extend for a little bit longer, maybe a couple more weeks before they start to rein it in. But it's sort of a testing ground at this point. Everybody is wondering if there's a Taliban 2.0 that is a more moderate version of the previous one that had become such an international pariah, and deservedly so.
There's one important point to keep in mind as we sort of think about what might happen in the weeks to come, and that is the Taliban obviously have the option of blockading access to Kabul International Airport, effectively making Americans and other foreign nationals in Kabul and elsewhere in the country hostages, which would greatly limit the ability of the Biden administration, other countries, to use military force to resolve the issue. So again, this takes us back to what is the game plan for the Taliban leadership? How long are they willing to pursue the current path they're on? And why are they making the choice to basically expedite the departure of foreign nationals from the country? And I've heard, you know, a variety of explanations. One, you pointed out, this is a new, more gentle Taliban. I'm not sure I buy that argument. Another one is that the Taliban are eager to get access to international aid and the like because they realize they're going to have a daunting challenge to do what you suggested, use 60,000 soldiers to try to run a country of more than 30 million people. Other arguments I've heard is that outside countries are putting pressure on the Taliban to basically go slow and to expedite peaceful passage of foreign nationals out of the country.
Jim, that's a good point. I also wanted to cite what I thought was an interesting interview I saw published this week in Politico magazine with the head of the media consortium that has really grown quite a bit with USAID funding, I should add, in Afghanistan and is still operating and has been able to conduct interviews with the Taliban officials, with women correspondents, among other things. And this individual was pointing out a few things that, again, they're like everyone else, they're kind of waiting to see what happens, but pointing out the country's demographic profile. 65% of the population is under 20. The median age of Afghanistan is 18. It's a whole generation. Two-thirds of the country basically have never lived under Taliban rule, don't have any kind of reference point to that, and are used to this sort of, even with all the troubles that Afghanistan has been enduring, even in recent years, are used to, at the very least, a free media and a somewhat free-willing troubling political situation. So that's one thing. But this person also pointed to the fact that the Taliban fighters have also been, especially those who were living in Afghanistan in recent years, have also been accustomed to a more open media, certainly social media. They've been very adept on social media platforms, WhatsApp, Facebook, Messenger, and so forth. So the interview went on to just say they're operating as if they can continue to operate and are sort of playing it by ear. But there are some new realities. Demography is sometimes destiny, sometimes it isn't. But it's going to be very interesting to see how the Taliban plays its cards in this new Afghanistan.
My sense, Bob, is that the Taliban leadership has been very sophisticated about its use of social media, particularly in broadcasting to audiences overseas, and I think particularly in the West. That's why the Taliban leader sitting down doing an interview with a female correspondent who is not wearing a face covering, things like that. Again, I don't take that as evidence that this really is a different Taliban. But one thing you said sort of struck me, Bob, and that's about the median age in Afghanistan, the relative youth, the fact that a large portion of the country has no memory of what Taliban rule was like. So what do you make of the news stories we're hearing early on that some Afghans have actually gone out to protest against the Taliban takeover?
Yeah, I think it's a test now. This is, again, a group of a whole cohort of Afghans who only know the ability to express themselves. And it's sort of the question of putting the genie of free expression back into the bottle of Taliban rule, which is what everybody expects. What's interesting is it's some of this has coincided with, I think today is the normal annual celebration of Afghan Independence Day, independence from Great Britain. That's 103 or so years ago. And as part of that, people were using that to sort of assert independence of Afghanistan, but also to kind of lower the white Taliban flags and try to raise the traditional, what had been the, in recent years, the Afghan flag. And so it's a question of whether the emirate, you know, of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is, as the Taliban want to be known as, is going to be able to assert itself right off the bat, or whether there's going to have to be all sorts of brokering going on and all sorts of bargaining in a new Afghanistan that's going to take place. What I've also found interesting is some of the commentary about, you know, some of the mistakes made up to this moment included the fact that apparently there were worse moments when the Afghan government structures were being formed, when the Taliban could have been brought into the process and weren't for various reasons. And that spoke to what some people said was a willingness of the Taliban to be part of a government that's not just a severe authoritarian Islamic-run government. So again, we're back to this question, Jim, of how much do we believe about the perceptions of a potentially new and improved, so to speak, Taliban that allows more participation, more enfranchisement, more women's rights, while also cloaked in Sharia and some sort of interpretation of Islam that's going to make the country a different place.
So my takeaway is that there remain a lot of big questions about how the Taliban are going to govern, whether they're going to be able to impose the rule over parts of Afghanistan, and to some extent, whether we might see something that has been part and parcel of Afghan over the course of its history, which is you may have a government in Kabul, but how things are ruled in the various provinces may vary greatly.
Absolutely, Jim. And I think that set of developments is going to be watched very closely in the region and internationally with important power brokers. And so I wanted to sort of ask you how foreign capitals are reacting to the collapse of what had been the U.S.-backed government. Are we going to see a sort of a big turn in global geopolitics, or is it something that we really can't get out of ourselves on?
Well, let me put off answering the question about whether the fall of the U.S.-backed government in Afghanistan marks a major turning point in global politics and just begin with how foreign capitals are reacting. It's perhaps best to start in the region. And I would say that when you look at Afghanistan's neighbors, there seems to be a lot of public schadenfreude over the collapse of the government in Kabul. I think it's fair to say there's been a fair amount of public delight in Beijing, Islamabad, Moscow, and Tehran at seeing Washington get its comeuppance. But I think in each of those capitals, there's also a fair amount of concern about the U.S. departure. And that's why a fair number of experts thought that countries like China, Russia, Iran, Pakistan would work to try to forestall the Taliban's return. Now, I know that there are a lot of news reports about how Beijing is looking to exploit the American departure. The Chinese firms are going to come in and work on extracting Afghanistan's huge amount of mineral resources, particularly in the case of rare earth metals and the like. But China very much has to worry about what the Taliban's return means for its own western province in Xinjiang in the issue of the Uyghurs. There have to be concerns in Beijing about foreign fighters coming across the border into China. I think that's one of the reasons why over the last several weeks we've seen the Chinese government rev up its own diplomacy in dealings with the Taliban. Likewise, if you look at Iran has to be greatly concerned about the return return of the Taliban. Again, this gets back to a religious difference. Iranians are Shia, Taliban staunch Sunnis, and there is a group known as the Hazaras, who are a religious minority in Afghanistan, who are Shia, who were oppressed and suppressed by the Taliban when they were in power back in the 1990s. And then you have Pakistan, which in many ways served as a sanctuary for the Taliban in its efforts to challenge the U.S. and Western militaries in Afghanistan. And it's pretty clear that the Pakistani military intelligence service, the ISS, helped bankroll and train Taliban fighters. But now Islamabad has to worry about the backlash or blowback from having the Taliban come into power again. So this is a real double-edged sword for the countries in the region.
Yeah, I think Pakistan in particular, people are going to have to watch closely, not only what Pakistan says, but what it does. And one of the reasons I say that is you had this interesting initial comment from, I believe, Prime Minister Imran Khan, that hearing that the Taliban had taken over, that the country was relieved of the shackles of mental slavery that it had been enduring. But as you say, Jim, there's a whole other side to this for Pakistan, which is blowback, which is another surge in refugees. Pakistan, for years, it had under previous Afghan civil war, it had the largest number of refugees on its soil. I think Turkey is now holds that dubious honor. But it was something like 3.5 million refugees, and it had really changed the nature of part of Pakistan over the time. And some say maybe even contributed to the Taliban's rise, which itself got its early boost from Pakistan. So Pakistan's going to be really interesting to watch for all sorts of reasons, I think.
Well, and I think Islamabad is particularly worried because Pashtuns, who are the dominant ethnicity in the Taliban, live on both sides of the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the concern is that the force that the Pakistani military services have created are going to come back and create violence in Pakistan itself. There have been a number of terrorist attacks in Pakistan over the last year or so that have their origins in groups that are from the Western Pashtun dominated part of Pakistan.
Yeah, it's an important point, Jim. I would also point out that, you know, in addition to China, Russia has been carrying out military exercises and continues to carry them out with Tajik forces along the border. Tajikistan has a fairly sizable border with northern Afghanistan. And Russia has all sorts of worrisome memories about Afghanistan. Obviously, its own legacy of defeat from the failed Soviet campaign after 9 years withdrawing in the late, I think, 89. But also the spillover in terms of radical fighters leeching across the border, in terms of drug trade. There's a lot of concern that what has still been a pretty robust opium trade is going to just take off in a more freewheeling environment under the Taliban. And the Taliban may end up becoming very used to the revenues from the drug trade if it's going to be facing prolonged international sanction or cutoff of aid.
Well, I do think that Russia is very concerned about the spillover of foreign fighters from Afghanistan. There are a very large number of foreign fighters on the side of the Taliban. Obviously, Russia has had the trouble in the Caucasus for a number of years, and the great concern that fighters will come back or make common cause, I think, remains a very real concern for the Kremlin. That said, I mean, I've been sort of focused our conversation on countries bordering Afghanistan. We probably should open the aperture and talk about reactions in other capitals, particularly in the capitals of American friends, partners, and allies. And I think there you're seeing reactions that range from dismay to real anger. And I think one of the things you have to keep in mind as we sort of think about Afghanistan, watch what's happening, you know, through social media or on television, that the foreign nationals that are trapped in Afghanistan aren't just Americans. Again, the United States was in Afghanistan and it had a NATO force with it. And there are foreign nationals from all of our allies there, and they're trapped. And I think in a number of capitals, people are very angry at what they see as an unwise decision to withdraw from Afghanistan by the Biden administration, a withdrawal that in their view came with no notification or consultation, and that has been implemented poorly and put their nationals at risk. So you can easily imagine how that plays into politics and concerns. And I think the broader issue is, you know, that many capitals friendly to the United States, there are real doubts about the future credibility of U.S. security guarantees if the Americans are going to walk away from Kabul, who else will they walk away from? But I think just as important about the competence of the Biden administration.
It's a really good point, Jim. And there's been a lot of press coming out of the capitals of U.S. allies saying, you know, Biden has undermined his America is back language by the way he has gone about this whole campaign. As you said, you know, from the very beginning of the announcement back in April that the U.S. was going to be withdrawing by 9/11, you had coming from places like Germany sort of astonishment, like, you know, they're hearing this first through media reports, not even hearing it from their friends and allies in the Biden administration. And NATO countries, it must be pointed out, they were in there very early on in this campaign. Not all of them were involved in the fighting. There was this big sort of discussion amongst NATO members about rules of engagement. But you had several members in particular, I believe it was the UK, Canada, the Dutch, did have people on the front lines and dying in fairly significant numbers. But other countries that committed to it, committed personnel to various nation building aspects that put people in dangerous circumstances, were from NATO countries and were from other countries. And as you say, Jim, there's a great deal of anger. There was an extraordinary session in the British Parliament this week, which we heard some really sort of raw emotion expressed towards the U.S., which was highly unusual. It's going to be, to say the least, the G7 summit meeting next week is going to be a very interesting assembly of leaders. And it'll be also curious to see how much they are able to move beyond this and come up with, I don't know, a new set of alignment, perhaps, on things like refugee issues. You know, the European Union has been scrambling to try to come up with a united policy on Afghan refugees after conjuring up the image of 2015 when you had this surge of mostly Syrian-backed refugees and what that created in terms of political upheaval, humanitarian crisis, and so forth. I think there's a great deal of concern that there's going to be some sort of self-inflicted wound here visited upon European countries, among others, by the U.S. actions that precipitated this huge sweeping move by the Taliban.
Well, Bob, I think in the weeks to come, we're going to be hearing a lot about the C word, credibility. And I think it's worthwhile to maybe take a moment to parse through that emerging debate. There are really sort of two schools of thought about countries' credibility. One school of thought argues that credibility lies first and foremost in your track record. And so from this vantage point, not standing by the American-backed government in Kabul, the Biden administration has really done great damage to American credibility because foreign leaders are now going to begin to doubt whether the United States is going to stand by its other security commitments. The contrary school of thought, which is where I belong, argues that credibility lies less in what you have done in the past and a lot more in what you have at stake on any particular issue. So from this vantage point, the argument would be Afghanistan was never a vital interest for the United States, that withdrawal was always going to be messy. And indeed, the Biden administration may have made it messier than it needed to be, but in the long run, it won't have a lasting impact because other countries are going to judge that the United States didn't have enough at stake in Afghanistan to stay there. And again, you know, the classic example you have in these debates is people look at Vietnam and say, you know, the United States withdrew from Vietnam. It was an ignominious withdrawal. We remember the pictures of helicopters lifting out of the embassy. But at the end of the day, Vietnam did not do irreparable damage to U.S. credibility among its alliance partners. Now, having said that, I also have to say that that doesn't mean that the same thing will automatically happen in the wake of the fall of the government in Kabul, because we're in just a different geopolitical time now than we were then. And I think what's really going to matter is people's assessments of the Biden administration's competence. And again, this was not a well-constructed withdrawal. I understand that the administration says nobody could have predicted that the government would fall that quickly. I would say the Biden administration violated one of the fundamental rules of policymaking, which is while you can hope for the best, you should always prepare for the worst. I know that administration officials have gone before the television cameras to say that the rapid collapse of the Kabul government was a surprise. But it seems to me there's a fair amount of precedent for rapid collapses of armies. Just think of the failure of the Iraqi army in the face of the Islamic State forces just 7 years ago. You know, or think about how the United States ousted the Taliban. You know, much of it came not through heavy combat, but groups switching sides and abandoning the government in Kabul. And I think why this really matters is that the Biden pitch to the allies was, and to the American public, that he was bringing into the U.S. government the kind of foreign policy professionals and professionalism that the Trump administration was lacking. But right now, those professionals look to have botched one of their main priorities, which has created very real doubts about their competence.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to the way the administration now is going to be messaging, you know, U.S. foreign policy priorities, Jim. They had to the president basically saying in comments this week, justifying the move, that the counterterrorism mission, in essence, was completed. There was not a compelling reason for the U.S. to maintain its troop presence in the country, and seemingly reducing Afghanistan to a counterterrorism arena, as opposed to a place where the U.S. had spent an enormous amount of money on nation building and on really, in some ways, trying to change the culture of the country. And I think this is going to reverberate. Certainly, people are raising this point in the U.S. and elsewhere. That's going to reverberate when the U.S. plans to hold its democracy summit at the end of the year, in terms of championing democracy. And what does that exactly mean? And what does that mean in terms of people sticking their necks out in various countries, maybe with U.S. funding, to hold risky political meetings or just setting up a political party? What is the U.S. willing to do to support that? And how much of that matters in the greater scheme of things in U.S. foreign policy priorities, Jim?
You're quite right, Bob, you know, that a lot of events are in play. And I would imagine, just going back to, you know, the question that I dodged at the top of this segment about the broader impact of Afghanistan, that much of it is going to turn on what happens next. You know, it's easy to tell a story where Afghanistan becomes much messier and the dilemmas that face the Biden administration become more intense and are poorly handled. But again, we could also tell a story in which Afghanistan actually goes in a reasonably good direction, if I can put reasonably good in air quotes. The United States is able to extract itself, focus on other issues. In a year, 2-3 years from now, we're not talking about Afghanistan as the major turning point in the course of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, Jim, and that's that point again of lessons learned. And you know, maybe we're just going to have to wait a while before the lessons sink in.
We do have a bit of impatience here in the United States to want to decide the meaning of events the moment they happen. But I think history suggests you have to wait and have some patience. But Bob, let's turn our attention to the reaction here at home. President Biden said in a national address on Monday that he stood squarely behind his decision to withdraw U.S. forces from Afghanistan. That hasn't saved him from a flood of criticism from Republicans and Democrats alike. Biden's critics have challenged him both for ordering a full withdrawal of U.S. troops and for the way that withdrawal has been carried out. Has Biden's presidency been badly damaged?
In the interim, this was not the kind of way the Biden administration wanted to end up the summer by any means, Jim, where it was, you know, getting close to seemingly an infrastructure deal and looking to consolidate its actions on the coronavirus and everything else. This is I think it's a major setback, but it is going to be something that we could see, apropos your previous comments, it could be something that recedes in the rearview mirror as other issues take hold and as Afghanistan potentially drifts into some sort of status quo situation that is not so urgent anymore. But I do think Republicans certainly sense that it's an opportunity to damage the Biden presidency. And there's certainly genuine Republican concern over the way this was handled and what it means for U.S. reputation, U.S. allies, and so forth. But there's no doubt also a sense that it's a way of continuing to build talking points against the president for his various steps in office. And there's been a lot of speculation, I won't get into it, about whether or not the Republican emphasis on border security, and we've seen record numbers of migrants coming across the U.S. southern border with Mexico, whether or not that has had any impact on the calculations the Biden administration has been making on accepting Afghans. We'll see how that plays out, but it's just become part of the domestic churn here that seems to be unavoidable now on any major issue. A number of people have pointed out that in the 2020 debates between President Trump and Democratic candidate Biden, the word Afghanistan came up exactly 0 times. But it does seem like something, at least at the moment, that's going to be a major talking point.
Bob, I have been struck on the issue of refugees coming from Afghanistan. How many governors, including Republican governors, have indicated publicly that their states are willing to host refugees from Afghanistan? So that seems to be sort of a good news story. We're not seeing, at least so far, political hay being made out of the entry or potential entry of Afghans coming in on so-called special issue visas. I also think it's very difficult to know at this point how Afghanistan's going to play out in terms of its domestic political impact. You know, you're obviously right. This is not how the Biden administration saw its summer coming to a close. They were hoping to sort of focus attention on a country that was overcoming the coronavirus, that had come together in a bipartisan way to pass an infrastructure package, and to use the reconciliation process to enact a major package of reforms in the American economy. Now, Afghanistan has sort of dominated the news, and we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that those big issues are still there. And for the Biden administration, the Delta variant has been surging, as we all know. Vaccination rates have been lower than the administration hoped. The bipartisan bipartisan infrastructure deal is still going along, but getting things through Congress is always dicey, especially in this very politicized, hyper-partisan world. So for the Biden administration, you have this situation in which all the stuff domestically might come together, curtail COVID-19, bipartisan infrastructure bill, the rest of the changes. And then again, you get to the other side and you say, August was a bad month, the fall was much better, or these could all interact. And all of a sudden, the Biden administration goes from having a whole slew of potential victories it could point to or accomplishments to having almost nothing to show. And I think that's a real problem for the administration.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of irony here, obviously, in that President Trump was eager to wind down the U.S. military mission in Afghanistan, wanting to actually do it before the end of his first term. Though he's been a critic of how Biden has handled this withdrawal, I think there's little doubt that he would have been pressing for the winding down of what has been called the Forever Wars. He was part of the seemingly a sizable part now of Republican base that does not want to see the continuation of these. And yet, you know, Biden in carrying through that and actually following through on a peace deal that the Trump administration made with the Taliban that was criticized by both Democrats and Republicans, Biden is, because of the execution of this, you know, aside from the merits of the U.S. withdrawing or not, but the execution of it has made it all about his own competence and dealing with a major foreign policy issue. And so it is going to be this big issue of how the U.S. is able to project force, project credibility, to your earlier point, Jim, and then show that it's a country that can get things done. And the verdict is out right now as we enter into another really tricky period involving the coronavirus as well.
Well, it certainly is, Bob. And I think the main concern to the Biden administration right now on the Afghanistan piece of the issue is that the White House, to some extent, is a hostage to events, or at least to the decisions that others make. As long as you have thousands of Americans remaining in Afghanistan, the decisions the Taliban makes can greatly affect politics here at home. You know, I think what has to be in the back of the mind of people in the White House right now, in the State Department, in the Defense Department, is what happens if the Taliban goes to the boot of Iran in 1979 and decides not to let Americans leave the country. What happens then? So this could end up being something that plays out for quite a long time. And the administration is going to have to plan for that worst case scenario, even as it hopes that the interests of the Taliban are in getting foreign nationals out of the country, not keeping them in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and your reference to President Biden saying the August 31st date was not set in stone and that the U.S. could stay far beyond that, we could indeed have that because of the number of American nationals in particular. Still in the country, the fact that some of them could be still in remote areas, you could have well beyond that August 31st date, a U.S. presence getting more and more tricky as the Taliban seek to assert their writ in the country. And certainly coinciding with the 20th anniversary of 9/11, which was supposed to be this, you know, sort of bookending of a U.S. mission, it could end up becoming a more sour reflection, Jim.
Well, this is what makes the Biden administration's messaging over the course of the summer so puzzling. They had to have known that there was a chance that things would go bad and go bad quickly. I mean, the president even gave an interview today, I believe, in which he said he always knew that it was going to be difficult to withdraw from Afghanistan. That said, rather than preparing Americans for that possibility, the position the administration took was that this was going to go smoothly. I mean, famously, Joe Biden said in early July that there's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of an embassy in Afghanistan. And of course, those words have been said back to him time and time again. I mean, it seems to me that the administration, once it made this decision, its best argument was one that the president came back to in his speech earlier this week, which is that, let me quote him here, the basic choice is, am I going to send your sons and daughters to war in Afghanistan in perpetuity? And that, I think, is the argument that is strongest for him in terms of the way the public responds. The problem is right now, to some extent, he is a hostage to events on the ground. They could go one way or they could go in a different way. In which way they go will have major political and policy consequences.
So we enter into a late summer period where Americans are going to be waking up to news of Afghanistan much more than they expected to. And it's going to get, I believe, more and more fraught, Jim.
There's certainly that chance, Bob. And I should note what it's doing is pushing off our TV screens and off the front pages of our newspapers and off our Twitter feeds, all the other things that are happening in the world right now that are of concern to the United States and that you hope there is an effective U.S. response. Think, for example, the earthquake and hurricane that have struck Haiti. Think of the terrible civil war that looks to be expanding in Ethiopia. Think about the administration's overall hope to try to put together a coherent, consistent, and effective policy for countering China. There's just a lot of other things going on. And, you know, while administrations can do more than one thing at a time, when you have big crises like this, it can be very hard to do more than one thing at a time.
And not to forget, there's more drama coming with the response to the coronavirus, with the decision to deploy booster shots in the U.S. and the reverberations that is having globally as well.
Yes, I think if you're in the Biden administration, you have to feel like your inbox is growing higher and higher despite all of your work to make it go lower and lower.
Yeah, Jim, and our inboxes, smaller as they are, will also be filling up, and we will be certainly covering this in our week ahead podcasts.
And Bob, I should note that if listeners want to learn more about what's going on in Afghanistan, they should tune in to the most recent episode of Why It Matters, another CFR podcast. Our colleague Gabrielle Sierra sat down this week with the council's president, Richard Haass, to discuss the history of the Afghan war and the question of what lessons can be learned in its aftermath.
And that's our look at the world next week with a special lens on Afghanistan. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky hosts the Crimean Platform Summit. The 2020 Paralympic Games begin in Tokyo. And U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is scheduled to visit Singapore and Vietnam.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe, for making us sound the best we can be. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.